Welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. My name is Molly McLaughlin, and I own a company that optimizes sleep through technology, accountability, and behavioral change. Each week, I'll be interviewing world-class experts ranging from doctors, innovators, and thought leaders to give actionable tips and strategies that you can implement to become a more skillful sleeper. Let's jump into your dose of practical sleep training. Welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. My guest today is Kara Collier, director at NutriSense, a continuous glucose monitor that's actually aiming to help support healthy individuals looking to improve their glucose stability and, of course, improve their sleep and circadian rhythm. Now, glucose and sleep is a fascinating relationship. When you bring stability to this area, sleep, health, and mood improvements tend to reliably follow. And until recently, most people wearing continuous glucose monitors were pre-diabetic, diabetic, or maybe just a fringe group of extreme biohackers who had, you know, finagled prescription from their doctor. But NutriSense is one of the few emerging companies on the scene right now looking to change that by removing the obstacle of needing a doctor's prescription to obtain a monitor. Most people don't know that glucose runs on a circadian rhythm, meaning when you eat actually matters, and in this conversation can play a role in your sleep results. So just one night of acute sleep deprivation can lead to a spike in glucose. Not only that, glucose reliably tends to rise when you're stressed or even when women are in their luteal phase. So get ready to learn more about the quite enthralling world of glucose and sleep. Now, a little bit about our guest. Kara is the director of nutrition at NutriSense, a company that uses continuous glucose monitors to personalize nutrition. She and her team of dietitians interpret complex glucose data sets in order to make lasting lifestyle changes, reverse metabolic dysfunction, and prevent chronic conditions. She's a registered dietitian nutritionist and certified nutrition support clinician with a background in clinical nutrition, nutrition technology, and entrepreneurship. All right. Welcome to the Sleep is a Skill podcast. I am so grateful that you're able to take the time to be here.
I'm so excited to be here, Molly. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yes. No, I'm really very curious on this topic. You know, I've been sharing with you on our preamble some of my relationship with glucose, of course, with as it relates with clients and sleep, and then just some own personal experiences and kind of diving in with monitoring glucose and then what that looks like for our health and, of course, our sleep. So I would love to just kind of start at the beginning, because I have tons of questions for you, but start at the top of just what had you get into this area and align with this company in particular around glucose?
Yeah, so I am a registered dietitian, and I started my career in a very traditional setting in the hospital in a clinical role. So I was mostly working in ICUs and cardiac floors dealing with very sick people. So I did that for a few years and basically became very, very frustrated with the whole hospital experience. I was seeing people way too late in their health journeys. So, you know, at this point, they're having severe complications from diabetes or heart disease, all of these lifestyle related conditions. And it is so much harder to reverse all that damage, and they've had disease or underlying problems for 40, 50 years than it is to prevent it or treating it early, which you never see in the hospitals. So I became very frustrated with that. And there was a lack of motivation for behavior change because people have habits that are just built upon for years and years. And so my interest in glucose and my work with NutriSense stemmed from what I was experiencing in the traditional healthcare setting in the hospital. So I helped start NutriSense, and I am the director of nutrition there. And the reason that I really wanted to focus on glucose, particularly continuous glucose monitors, which is the technology we use at NutriSense, is because the CGMs make this combination of a very meaningful metric, which is glucose. It tells us about health. I'm sure we'll dive all in that. And it's really at the root of a lot of these lifestyle chronic conditions, lifestyle related chronic conditions that afflict so many millions of people. So glucose is related to diabetes, cardiovascular disease, dementia, kidney disease, all of these most common chronic conditions. So combined, it tells you a ton of information about your body related to metabolic health, but it's also a driver for behavior change. So it solves this problem of a lack of motivation or lack of knowledge about how you should be healthier. So with a continuous glucose monitor, you're having constant feedback from your own body, and that makes it much more meaningful to make real lifestyle changes. And it makes it easier to know what you should be doing, because rather than following, you know, vague advice or whatever diet happens to be trendy this month, you're actually getting data from your own body. And so you know whether this is a good decision or a bad decision, and you can make a plan accordingly. And so I'm all about data-driven behaviors. And so that's what we're trying to do at NutriSense. You know, we're combining this data, and we're also using dietitians. So every person gets paired with a dietitian, because we believe that a bunch of data without any signal is just a bunch of noise. So we're really trying to also help people understand what's going on with their data so they can make the most of their health. So that's kind of where it came from and where I'm at now, and why I'm super excited about this work, because we're actually catching things early so people can live a long, happy life. And the whole goal is prevention.
I love that. Wow. Incredible. And just to underscore in the intro, I'll kind of go into this, but to let people know kind of what's unique about you guys and what you're offering, for most of us across the general consensus, when you think of continuous glucose monitors, previously it was something very wrong, or you had diabetes, something was really significant enough to get a prescription to warrant something like that to be worn 24/7. However, this allows the ability for anyone to actually be able to glean the insights that you can get from wearing this 24/7. And just a quick aside, so you're on your part of what you're offering too is just the ease of being able to bypass that ability or the need to then go to your doctor and get a prescription and all the kind of hoops that we have to go through to get that normally, right?
100%. Yeah. So a continuous glucose monitor is a medical device, and it does require a prescription. So typically these devices are only being given to type 1 diabetics or very insulin dependent type 2 diabetics. Only about 30% of type 2 diabetics even use a CGM. So it's not even widespread for that population. And it's about 0.001% of non-diabetics are using a CGM. And so if you go to your doctor and you ask for a prescription for this, and you're doing it for the hopes of preventative health or personalized nutrition, there's a very strong likelihood that they will not write that prescription for you, which I find very unfortunate. And so that is why we are doing this. We're trying to remove that barrier to entry, try to help people get this device and learn about their bodies. Yeah. So helping to bypass that, because it's not easy, unfortunately. Many physicians aren't taught about nutrition or taught about the importance of preventative health. They're used to thinking about treatment-based health, which is, you know, traditional healthcare system is you come in with a problem and you treat it. It's not very focused on prevention. So it is hard to get these types of devices and these types of information. So that's what we're trying to help people with.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a fascinating insight into what's going on, the cause and effect of the relationship with what we put in our mouth and then what happens as a result, but also a number of other things beyond even just food, which is super fascinating. But for the sake of the target of this conversation, I would love to hear more information from you about glucose and sleep. How are those two things connected, and what can we kind of glean from monitoring this area as it relates to improving and optimizing our sleep?
Yes, absolutely. So I always tell everybody that starts in our program that there's four pillars to good glucose control, and all of them are equally important. And it's, you know, food, exercise, stress, and sleep. So sleep is just as important as what we're putting in our body. Yeah. So sleep and glucose works in a bidirectional relationship. So on the one hand, if you have poor sleep, inadequate sleep, that's going to greatly affect your glucose levels the next day. And then the other direction, if we're going to bed with high glucose levels, it's going to affect our quality of sleep. So I can dive into each of those relationships.
Yeah. If you'd like. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah. So the first is that, you know, poor sleep affects our glucose levels the next day. This is seen over and over around the board. So poor sleep is a form of chronic stress, right? So I'm sure your audience is very aware that sleep is this essential time for restoration and repair at the cellular level. And in addition to, you know, our normal sleep-wake cycles, circadian rhythms also regulate our hormones that affect metabolism, like insulin and glucose and leptin, things that affect our appetite. So when our circadian rhythms are out of sync, our body's metabolic health also gets out of sync. And so there's two different aspects to this. The first is, you know, if you're having sleep fragmentation, is if, you know, that deep sleep, that slow wave sleep, if that's being, if you're not achieving that deep sleep, then you're going to have higher glucose values the next day. So there's a lot of research about this, of if you're getting 8 hours of sleep, but it's disrupted, poor sleep, on average, people have about 25% higher glucose values the next day. So that's pretty significant. Mm. It both decreases our insulin sensitivity and it increases our endogenous glucose, the glucose we're making from our own body. So that's one aspect. And then the other aspect is just sleep insufficiency, right? So not getting however many hours of sleep you personally need. So, you know, most people probably about 8 hours, but you're getting around 4 or 6, glucose values again between 25 to 40% higher the next day. We have about 25% decreased insulin sensitivity. And that's pretty significant. So yeah. That's on an acute level. It's much easier to do research and study acute sleep deprivation, right?
Yeah.
It's harder to study chronic sleep deprivation. So there's not as many human research trials on the effect of chronic sleep deprivation on glucose, but there's plenty of associational data on this. So it's pretty clear, as you can imagine, if acute sleep deprivation has that sort of effect, that chronic sleep deprivation is only going to worsen that. So there's very strong correlations between metabolic syndrome, diabetes, insulin resistance, and poor sleep.
So fascinating. And then, so with that, could you speak a little bit, because I know you know this so in and out, of kind of the vicious cycle that then can get created when, say, for instance, we happen to go through a period of either, like you said, chronic sleep deprivation. Unfortunately, to your point, we don't have as many studies around that, but so either going through a period of that and or a really acute situation of sleep deprivation. And then the next day we wake up and now our glucose is more unstable than normal. What can kind of happen to create the snowball effect so that we get into some bad habits from that point on?
Yeah, absolutely. So unfortunately, you know, we have this compounding effect with the poor sleep where our glucose values are higher and our insulin is lower. So insulin sensitivity is lower. So then, you know, if we're tired and we reach for a bag of chips or something that's maybe would normally have an impact on our glucose values, it's going to be even worse than normal because we're already having these high glucose levels and we don't have the insulin system to process it as well. And unfortunately, we also know that poor sleep also increases hunger, cravings. Yes. Uh-huh. People tend to just eat more. It lowers our leptin and it raises our ghrelin, which are the two hormones, the yin and yang of our appetite regulating hormones, right?
Right.
So leptin is like our satiety hormone. So this helps us feel satisfied after meals. This decreases with poor sleep. And then ghrelin, which is, you know, our hunger hormone, the opposite end of the spectrum, that increases when we get poor sleep. So that is a recipe for danger. That's increased hunger and carb cravings in a state where we're going to have a higher glucose response to food in the first place. So that can be quite a vicious cycle. I think the first step in dealing with this, besides just getting better sleep, is acknowledging that this is existing. If you know I'm having more carb cravings or cravings for foods I know aren't good for me, it's because I'm tired. It's not because I need that food, right? So it's first about acknowledging it so you can try to compensate and not reach for those chips when you're feeling tired and hungry and crabby. But it's difficult, you know, those are hormones have a very real effect on our brain and our choices. So we're fighting our biology in this stance.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Such a very important point. And I love what you said, that it really becomes first about the acknowledgement and the understanding of that, which I think is so elegantly demonstrated with your product, because it allows for anyone to be able to see so clearly in black and white kind of what's going on and then choose accordingly. Really, really great. And then a couple questions I have around that as it relates to sleep is, then some people that I'll work with will go to, but if I have carbs at night, then I'll just pass out. I'm able to, that helps me to put me to sleep. What have you noticed about that for trends with people and how that could potentially maybe backfire, or the strategy might be not so solid?
Yeah, I would say with glucose, we have a very large range of just variability between people. So, you know, how I respond to a certain food is not going to be the same as how you respond to a food. And so we have all this intervariability, but also there's a few universal truths, right? And what I see, again, across the board with almost everyone is that we do not tolerate food, especially carbohydrates, later at night. We are naturally less insulin sensitive at night. Our insulin works on that circadian rhythm, just like, you know, melatonin and our other hormones. And so we are less insulin sensitive at night. And so somebody will eat the same exact meal. You know, maybe you have rice and beef, and you could eat that at noon and maybe have a glucose increase of 40 points. And you could eat that at 9 p.m. and your glucose will likely be 60, 70 points higher. It's across the board. Everybody has a higher glucose response to meals at night. So it's one thing I'm telling everybody is that eat within your circadian rhythm. A good rule of thumb is eat during daylight hours and try to avoid eating when it's dark out. Give yourself at least 3 hours between bed and your last bite of food. And it may feel like, you know, if you have carbs right before bed, you pass out. But it's a very similar situation as if you maybe have like a nightcap or alcohol right before bed.
Yeah.
You may be passing out, but I promise you, your quality of sleep is not going to be the same. And so that's sort of the other direction of the glucose and sleep relationship, right? So high glucose levels going into sleep, it alters our sleep quality. So we may fall asleep faster, but it triggers our nervous system to be more on alert, which causes an increase in cortisol and adrenaline, and we just don't sleep as well. We don't get into those really high quality sleep patterns. And so it's something I really urge against doing. I would not recommend for probably anybody to be consuming a lot of carbohydrates right before bed, just like I wouldn't recommend consuming alcohol right before bed. It's really going it's going to make your sleep take a hit pretty much across the board.
So wise. Yeah, absolutely. And thanks too for underscoring the very individualistic elements of this, that each person is going to respond really differently to different things that we'll be testing for. So that's why it's so powerful to see individually with the system that you guys have with the NutriSense and the continuous glucose monitoring going straight to your phone to be able to check in regularly and not be, you know, kind of reliant that, oh, my results are going to be the same as the Instagram account I follow that shows me that, or the friend that's doing it too, or whatever. Yeah, big deal there. And then my other question too is around wake up. So a lot of my clients might, you know, be okay with the sleep latency part of things and fall asleep fine, but then they're waking up multiple times throughout the night. Now, of course, that can be related to many different things, but I'm wondering if you could share about how any of that might be related or linked with glucose.
Yes, definitely. So I have a lot of people that come to me because they are waking up in the middle of the night and they're thinking they're getting like nocturnal hypoglycemia. And that's actually very uncommon. I see that very rarely. And what's usually happening is the opposite. They're having these high glucose levels while they sleep. And that's waking them up because their nervous system is on alert, like I said. So they're not getting into those deeper levels of sleep. So the hypoglycemia I see every once in a while if somebody's drinking a lot before bed, because that just alters our liver's regulation of glucose and insulin. So when we're in a fasted state, our liver is taking control of our glucose regulation. You know, it's balancing insulin and glucagon to make sure that glucose levels are at an appropriate range. But when we have a lot of alcohol in our system, the liver is like, I'm prioritizing detoxing this alcohol because it's a toxin right now.
Right.
And so it's like, I'll deal with glucose later. And so we'll sometimes see these hypoglycemic dips in the middle of the night after a lot of drinking, especially if drinking is more of a chronic pattern. But usually it's the opposite, these high glucose levels during sleep. And what happens a lot of the times when you have these larger meals at night, or you consume, you know, these kind of refined, easy to digest carbohydrates later in the evening, because our insulin sensitivity is lower, that spike might happen 3 or 4 hours after you've eaten. So it might already be when you've fallen asleep, and that's when your glucose is starting to rise, because everything is just kind of delayed at that time. Your body is not primed to be processing this nutrient load at midnight. And so everything gets a little delayed, and then your body is working on processing this while you're sleeping. And that is not a recipe for great sleep. So that's usually what I'm seeing when people are actually thinking it's hypoglycemia.
So great. Yeah. Thank you for clarifying that. So I loved how you mentioned that people will often come to you complaining of their wake-ups or difficulty with their sleep. Could you share some of your, just a couple of the most important things to remember that you share with your clients when looking to improve their sleep and improve their glucose regulation? Just, you know, a couple of the must-dos, must-dos, but the recommended practices, you know, to help kind of begin to bring more of a controlled state to this area.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I'm sure your listeners are aware, you know, there's a lot of great sleep hygiene tips out there. So we do touch on these things, you know, refer them to your information is great.
Yes, of course.
Of just like, you know, light and cold room and a wind down period. So we talk about these things, but, you know, we focus a lot on making sure that glucose levels are in a good range for optimal sleep. So like I said, there's kind of these five pillars of really good glucose management. They're all related. So the first one, just kind of touch on each one. The first one is food. So, you know, what we put in our body is, of course, going to have a huge impact on our glucose levels. So what comes to mind most for people is carbohydrates, right? So I am not anti-carb. I think carbohydrates have a place and a time. And I think a lot of whole food-based carbohydrates can be a very healthy aspect of someone's life. I also think, you know, if you're doing a ketogenic diet or very low carb, that also has a time and a place and can be done well. So what I'd like to say, though, is we want to titrate carbs to our lifestyle. So if you're very physically active, you're burning through your glycogen stores often, you're moving around all day long, you have a much higher carbohydrate tolerance than someone who is sedentary all day, maybe injured, not able to work out. So that's the first thing to keep into account, is titrate your carbohydrate intake to how much you're moving throughout the day and how much you're exercising. Our modern carbohydrate recommendations of, I think the dietary guidelines are like 45 to 65% of your calories from carbohydrates. That's really pretty high. Like those recommendations are supposed to be for the general population. And I have seen very few people who can eat that many 65% of their calories from carbohydrates and have good glycemic control. So going off of the traditional nutrition recommendations, I would maybe be a little wary of, unless you're like a professional athlete, we probably need to dial down total carbohydrates a little bit. So that's the caveat I will make, is that, you know, focus on what works for you, but 65% of your calories from carbs is probably not going to work for anybody.
Right.
And then, I don't know where those recommendations came from.
I second that.
Don't listen to what we tell you as a government. but at the very top level of food recommendations, quality is the most important thing about food. So as close as you can get to whole foods, the better off you're going to be. So, you know, that's choosing an apple over juice. that's choosing steel cut oats over oat milk. Oat milk is something that spikes everybody, yes. Trust me.
Yeah.
And so it's about the quality of your food, you know, as close to the original state as possible. And I promise you it's going to solve 80% of food problems. You know, one general sweeping rule of that is what I would say, and really be wary of those refined carbohydrates, processed foods, added sugar. You know, sugar gets added to everything these days. So just be very vigilant about reading ingredients labels. If the food you're eating has an ingredient label, look at that over anything and try to decipher what has been added to it. But the least processed, the better.
Oh, yeah.
So that's sort of, yeah, my golden rule for food. And so then if we're going to the next pillar, it's sort of related to food, but this is like fasting and meal timing. So if nutrition is the what of, you know, what we're eating, then fasting meal timing is all about the when we're eating. So a big one that I always touch on this is what we already said, those earlier dinners, trying to align your eating with your circadian rhythm. And then the other big aspect of this is just kind of avoiding that grazing like type of eating. So those a bite here, a bite there every 30 minutes to an hour, then our body is constantly in this fed state. And we want it to sometimes be in a fasted state, right? So as a good rule of thumb, 14 hours of fasting in a day works for most everybody. I've seen very few people respond poorly to that. You know, maybe we would do less fasting if you're recovering from an eating disorder, if you're pregnant or breastfeeding, but that's a very small percentage of the population. And for most people, at least 14 hours of fasting a day is going to be a good thing. And sometimes more, you know, if you're insulin resistant or metabolically inflexible, fasting is something we're really going to pull on as a lever to help improve your glucose values. Also depends on, you know, where you're at in the metabolic spectrum of health.
Wow, really interesting. I love that. And at Sleep as a Skill, we'll often point to, it sounds like we're, you know, very, very aligned, you know, we'll point to circadian rhythm, intermittent fasting. And then for some who want to even experiment a little bit more, further early time-restricted feeding. So kind of the flip-flop of the skipping breakfast, only having lunch and dinner, instead kind of the flip of that. So you're having breakfast and then kind of almost a dinner, like a lunch dinner,
yeah.
One of those.
Absolutely. I love that you recommend that because yeah, that's something we're pushing a lot. It's easier, right. I think, for people to fast until the evening and have one big meal because it's easier once you start eating in the beginning of the day and social. And I understand that those aspects are hard and our schedules throw a challenge in this. But if possible, I recommend the same thing, that earlier eating window. It's going to help our sleep. It's going to help our glucose values. And that's really what the body is designed to do. So we're just eating more in line with our biology that way. So I definitely recommend the same thing.
So interesting.
And that's one thing in you know, recent times where we're still, some of us are still in lockdown here,
yes.
But you know, a lot of terrible things came out of COVID-19 and lockdown, but a lot of people got this opportunity for the first time in their lives to work from home and be in charge of their own eating schedule. And I got to see a lot of people be able to, for the first time ever, experiment with their eating schedule and eat these earlier meals and shift their time restricted eating window. And I think that's been a really awesome thing that I've gotten to experience, at least out of all this. So silver lining.
Oh, I love that. No, that's such a great perspective. And actually, as we speak to COVID and the lockdown, I was wondering if you've seen changes for people in alcohol consumption, and if we can just touch on what alcohol does for glucose and the types of spikes, and if there's any way to gamify the types of alcohol we use, you know, because I always get questions about, is there anything we can do to still maintain? Because pretty much, as we know around sleep, it's just like, it's one of the easiest things to trash your sleep, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And so if I keep getting questions around it, I'll say, oh, okay, well, if you must, then moving it earlier in the day, you know, kind of more of a a boozy brunch or a happy hour.
But daytime drinking is going to be way better. Yeah,
it's very strange rationale.
Productivity, but it's much better for your sleep and your glucose value. So.
And your glucose value. Yes, so I'm wondering if you could share just one, just a primer on what alcohol does to glucose, and two, is there any sort of scale or spectrum of types of alcohol or strategy, if at all, just a little into that.
Definitely. So alcohol can affect our glucose in a variety of ways, really depending on the type of alcohol. If I have one recommendation of don't ever do this, it would be to combine, you know, liquid sugar with alcohol. That is just the worst thing you could probably put your liver through. Like, it's probably high fructose corn syrup plus alcohol, and that is just, that's torture to your body. So if anything, avoid sugary cocktails. That's like, please try to not do that. But the type of alcohol will have a variety of effects. So sugary cocktails and, you know, heavier beers will likely lead to an immediate increase in glucose just because they're higher in carbohydrates. But often liquor and dry wines will have no immediate effect on glucose. And sometimes they can even slightly lower glucose values, like I was saying. But many people, so even if they experience, you know, no change in their glucose in the moment or a couple hours after, or even if they have that dip, many people will observe these higher fasting glucose values and overall glucose levels the next day. And this is just due to impaired glucose tolerance, even just from one drink. I hate to say it, but it does happen. Yeah. So alcohol is impairing those normal functions in the liver, like I said. So it's this balance of insulin and glucagon, and it can temporarily interfere with our liver gluconeogenesis, so making new glucose, and also glycogenolysis, so breaking down stored glucose. So that's why we might see a dip in the night. And then the next day, our insulin level, our insulin sensitivity is impaired, and we might see higher values as the liver is trying to refigure things. So it can impair sleep for that reason. And then the next day, you might have higher glucose values all day and a higher glucose spike to foods you normally tolerate well. So if you are going to do it, definitely the liquor or the dry wine over sugary cocktails, please. And then, yeah, during the daytime hours is definitely better, or at least a few hours before bed, preferably not right before bed. That would be worse. Give your body a little bit of time to process before you try to go to sleep.
Absolutely. No, great information. And I was also wondering if you, I know this question's a little more subjective. So if you guys aren't kind of pulling for some of this information, that's fine. I was just wondering, so many people that are having difficulty sleeping often are exhibiting, you know, signs of kind of hyper-aroused brain state at night, but also throughout the day, kind of more anxious, kind of just rumination patterns. And so there are many pointing to this concept of glucose and anxiety. So I'm just wondering if you've been able, even on a subjective in speaking with your clients, if you've noticed as they begin to stabilize, if there are those reports of less anxiety or more mood stabilization, emotional regulation, or if you're not tracking for that.
Yeah. So it's definitely anecdotally, we're not tracking in hard data, but 100%. And interestingly, I'll have a lot of people who come to me thinking they're having this reactive hypoglycemia. They think they're having these dips, and that's brain fog and anxiety and heart palpitations. But really, it's the opposite. They're feeling high glucose values, and it's making them feel anxious, and it's making them feel stressed. And then when we can kind of regulate that with some diet alterations, they feel much better, like, you know, as our bodies are wanting to feel. And so that's the thing I see often, you know, maybe tangentially related to that. But stress and glucose are also very, very tightly linked. So, you know, in a normal stress response, our cortisol is increased, which causes our glucose to increase. So that's a normal stress response because our body wants energy to deal with the stressor at hand. But often our stressors don't actually require extra energy. You know, we're no longer running away from a tiger or dealing with, you know, a work problem. And so chronic stress is this constantly elevated glucose. So probably the most common cause of elevated fasting glucose levels is because of chronic stress. So stress is something that we're talking about all of the time. It's a huge problem, as I'm sure you're aware of your clients too. It's probably very related.
And that's why I just think something like this can be so empowering for people, because once you see it in black and white, kind of this clear biofeedback throughout the day, every day for multiple days or months, or, you know, however long you choose to dive in on this, to then see that then your mood is so closely linked to your physicality, right, and your physiology. It's just fascinating. And then it really can be so empowering to see, okay, I really am in the driver's seat on this topic, and there's so many things that I can do to impact this and my emotional state. So
100%. Yeah. A lot of people will be able to say that, you know, they're enhancing their mind-body connection. When you can see with data what's happening inside your body, it's so much easier to identify, like, oh, this is what high glucose values look like. This is what it looks like when I'm dipping low. And so you really enhance that connection, and it helps to reinforce behavior, like you said. So things normally like our mood or stress levels are so hard to quantify that it can feel overwhelming. And so being able to see it with the data, when you see you're in a super stressful moment and your glucose is climbing, it is a good reinforcement of, okay, I need to do some deep breathing. I need to calm down because I can see my body responding. It's so much easier than if you don't have any sort of biofeedback. So it's a very useful tool.
So true. Okay. So kind of along that same line of this stress management, what about caffeine? What do you tend to see for that? And I know it's obviously very individual based on the person, but are there certain things that you do see overall that kind of apply to most?
Caffeine has been such an interesting thing, because I would say it's probably a 50-50 split. Some people will see no change in glucose at all. They're not seeing any subjective change, like in their feelings. And then for other people, it initiates a small glucose increase. Okay. And so for those people, we're seeing that almost as a small stress response, you know, increased cortisol and adrenaline. I think it depends on the person. Yeah. And it's easier to identify this, of course, when you have the data to back it up rather than trying to figure it out in your head. But it tends to be very unique to the individual. So there's not a clear answer, unfortunately, for the general population, but it's a split on how somebody might respond.
Well, I think it just further speaks to how unique we, you know, all these different sets of variables that we're each bringing into the conversation, why something like this, even if someone did just like a month looking at this,
I mean,
the difference that could be gleaned, or the understanding that could be gleaned by doing something like this, is just really, really fascinating. And then on the topic of women, you know, I'm still staying on that kind of stress topic, and I'm wondering different points throughout our cycle for women of kind of childbearing years, and of course, then moving into perimenopause, menopause, have you been able to see different clear kind of variables, or is it still something?
No, 100%. Yeah. So, and that's something that we try to talk to all, you know, women who are not menopausal about, is just these changes in our body during our menstrual cycle. So during the luteal phase specifically is when most women tend to have higher glucose values just at baseline. So this is when progesterone peaks and estrogen is lower. It's, you know, the week 3 or 4 between ovulation and menstruation. And it's also, unfortunately, when we're usually having like mood swings and cravings and bloating, but we're also have higher glucose values at this time and decreased insulin sensitivity. So making women aware of this change, and we encourage women to track their menstrual cycle within the app, so you can compare week by week what's happening with your glucose. You know, we have analytics where it can tell you your average and help kind of aggregate that data, because it can be hard to, you know, maybe understand the trends on such a macro level if you're looking at it as week by week for months. But most women do experience these higher glucose values during the luteal phase specifically. So it might be a time where you want to dial back a little bit on carbs. I personally am very sensitive to this effect. Some women barely see a change, and I see a much higher just baseline glucose values during this. So I try to dial back my carbohydrates. I try to be extra careful about eating within, you know, that window, you know, all the normal factors, but I'm just more careful about it. And I think it's important for that awareness so that people can then, you know, make their own decisions based on that. But we need to know that these changes are very real and happening for most people.
So wise. So, I mean, you must, just from a data perspective, must just be collecting such a really interesting set of information on all these women and how their exercise at certain times of the month are impacting their glucose and some of their baselines and things to be aware of. And they can really kind of plan in a way that's so mindful that can help support the functioning of their body in a way that not many people are privy to that level of information.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, we are probably, one of the first people to be measuring all of this data in non-diabetics. So when we were starting the company and diving into all the research, there's so little research about continuous glucose data for non-diabetics. Yes. It's slim. And so a lot of it in the beginning was trying to figure out what's normal, what's not normal. And now that, we've seen thousands of people at this point, it's very clear what's normal, what's not normal. But most people have probably, never seen as much glucose data on a non-diabetic as I would have seen. I would probably bet. And if somebody is listening and they think they have, please reach out. I would love to chat about it.
Yes, you guys could have your own small support group of like three people.
I haven't found really very many other people.
Probably no one. Oh, that's fascinating. And then just quickly, I'm wondering too, if we could, I know there's a few, not everyone, but a lot of people that are listening to this tend to be looking to find, that kind of the biohack of things. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm gonna eat a lot of something not so great for me on Friday. So what can I do to support that type of situation? I've heard from different people these concept of apple cider vinegar, certain supplements, walking after. Are those things mm-hmm. all valid? And do you see any other glaring things that people could bring in? Besides, of course, abstinence from that.
Yeah, absolutely. The apple cider vinegar really does work. I was wary of how much of a difference it was going to make. It really works. It definitely lowers glucose. Amazing. Yes. So that's a thing. Berberine is the supplement that helps the most with glucose control. So about 500 milligrams twice a day is a good dose if you want to take that. It mimics the same functionalities that metformin does, which is, the most common oral medication for diabetes. But it's a plant, it's an herbal supplement. So berberine is great if somebody wants to take that if they're going to eat a big meal. If you're going to really go all out, try to eat it during daytime hours. Like we said, don't do your big... Right. All out meal right before bed. So for carb hacks, we always talk about, timing your carbs. You're going to eat like a big whatever after physical activity, definitely. When we're exercising, we're clearing some of our glycogen storage space. We're making more room for glucose to come in. We're increasing GLUT4 transporters. So these are the transporters that help take glucose from the blood and store it into the muscles as glycogen. So it increases that and it increases our insulin sensitivity. So we can tolerate more carbohydrates or maybe a cheat meal after exercise than if we were just sitting around and eating it. And then also the timing of how you eat the food. So eating refined carbohydrates or sugary things on an empty stomach or the first thing in your mouth is going to have a much higher spike than if maybe, like, let's say you're having pancakes and eggs. You eat the eggs first and then the pancakes, it's going to be a much smaller glucose response than if you ate the pancakes first and then the eggs. So that's just a really easy hack that people can use, is just do your protein and fat first and then you can follow with the carbohydrates. So that follows with a similar rule of what we call no naked carbs. So eating carbohydrates by themselves leads to a higher glucose response. So pairing it with a little bit of protein or fat helps to blunt that glucose response.
So interesting. Maybe you could have that as an add-on for your packages to have like the first entry gift kit type thing of apple cider vinegar and the berberine, the whole thing. It's like, you're ready to rock. Let's experiment.
That's a good idea.
So, and I'll try to be mindful of your time. I know I have so many questions, so I'll try to keep it brief by the end here, but just wondering a couple of things with the, a lot of the people that we're working with at Sleep as a Skill, we're also applying different heat and cold therapies. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you've seen anything particularly interesting when people are either dealing with more extreme heats, sauna or cold therapy, anything that kind of is noteworthy as it relates to your glucose and insulin?
Yes. So they will have an opposite effect on our glucose levels. So cold therapy will plummet your glucose levels. That definitely works, which is very fascinating to see. And you're not going to have the same hypoglycemic symptoms that if your glucose was dipping for other reasons. So that works very well to lower glucose a little bit. And then in a sauna or heat therapy, it's going to rise. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. It's mostly related to a fluid distribution change that occurs. It's especially pronounced in the sauna with very high heat. So about 50% of our blood flow is redistributed from the core to the skin to facilitate sweating. And then that heat also increases our plasma volume to mitigate the decrease in core blood volume. So all of this basically translates to higher glucose values in the moment. And our glucose is also very sensitive to dehydration. So if you're feeling, you know, dehydrated during a sauna session, it may look higher than it really is. And that just could be attributed to dehydration. But there's a lot of research linking sauna use to lower fasting glucose values overall. So this might be a similar thing of what we see with exercise.
Yeah.
So very intense exercise is relying on glucose for energy. You know, we can't tap into fat stores for an all-out sprint. We need glucose and it's glycolytic. We need that fast energy. And so you might see a glucose spike if you're doing really intense exercise, but you're going to see lower glucose values the rest of the day because of all those factors we talked about that change during exercise with the increased insulin sensitivity and GLUT4 transporters. So a similar thing is sort of happening with sauna. You might see a spike, but you should see lower values the rest of the day.
So interesting. And then as it relates to the dehydrations, many of the athletes that I'll work with to try to improve their sleep, they'll find dehydration affecting their HRV. And I'm just wondering if, as a, you know, many of the supplements or things that people will take to try to improve their hydration, if they are doing some more of those more extreme things, extreme exercise, the sauna, all that stuff, a lot of them seem to have a lot of sugar in them. So do you recommend just kind of a DIY of throwing some like certain things in the water or just make sure you're drinking copious water? Any suggestions on that?
Yeah, for most people, I think just drinking enough water is going to be sufficient.
Yeah.
For high level athletes, we might need to add in a little, you know, something else, you know, glucose potentially. Mm-hmm. But for your weekend warrior, your average athlete, Gatorade does not really have any sort of appropriate place in our diet, and water is definitely going to do. Yeah. Elite athletes is definitely not my area of specialty, so
sure.
I'm sure that they have a different level of electrolyte replenishment that is necessary,
yeah.
But there's not a need for that in most people.
Most people, got that. Okay, so much amazing information, and I'm wondering if you could just share with us too, what are some of the recommended use case? Because for some people, again, they might be hearing about this connection or making this link of, okay, I'm curious about this, but I've maybe always for so long, I thought this was something just for a certain type of person. So I don't really have anything glaringly wrong with my health. Is this worth it for me? What are some of the recommendations you make? What do you see people having? Are they doing this for a short period of time? Can they do this for a year? What are the recommended time lengths?
Yeah. So we offer a few different options. One is just one CGM. You get the app that tracks all your data and you get access to the dietitian. So it lasts 14 days. And that's good if you just kind of want to get a quick diagnostic picture of your health. You know, you just kind of want to see how you respond to a few different foods. You're mostly just curious and you want to see how you're doing. Standard lab values to assess our glucose values have a lot of flaws. So you can't really get a good picture of how you respond to different foods, how your metabolic system is working with just a hemoglobin A1C, for example. So that's a good use case for that 2-week period that we offer. And then we also offer longer periods. So 3 months, 6 months, 12 months. And this is much better if you really want to learn a lot about your body. If you want to dive into the nuances of how sleep is affecting your health or stress is affecting your health, or if you want to try out different diets because you need more than 2 weeks to really see if something's working for you or not. And this is also good if you have a lot of behavior change you need to make. So we also have a lot of people, we have about 50% of our customers, I would say, are super healthy, biohacker type. And they, you know, do the monthly program as well because they just want to really like optimize and tune in. And then about 50% of our customers are maybe pre-diabetic, overweight, insulin resistant, menopausal, having some sort of, you know, red flag, but not a major health issue that they need to work on. And it's really about preventative health and catching that stuff before it becomes diabetes, right? So you need more time to really develop a good lifestyle routine for yourself and have that accountability from the real-time data to drive true behavior change. So that's sort of the two areas, two types of people we see the most often.
Sure. No, it's fascinating information. We'll leave in the show notes too some info on different signups so you can get a little bit of a discount off on whatever, you know, if you are someone that's deciding, okay, let me dip into this, let me try or go all the way and get a, you know, part of the 3 month, 6 month type of package and really test a few things. I've had a few clients that have been curious as they've been attempting to transition into, say, like keto and want to really get a more fine tune on kind of what's working, what's not working, and seeing how that's impacting their sleep or paleo, you know, any of these different types of dietary choices, and to really get up under that and see what is working, what's not working on a more granular state. And of course, in the area of sleep, it just like it's so continuously fascinating how much of this rhythmic element is involved, to your point around the circadian rhythm. We're always talking about that at Sleep is a Skill, and just to see how pervasive it is in the functionality of our body on in this level. And then so many people that have difficulties with hormones and the hormone dysregulation that's impacting their sleep can very much be found in this area of the timing of our foods, the type of our foods. So just such a fascinating thing. So where can people learn more about you and follow kind of what you guys are up to?
Yeah, so you would sign up for the program or learn more about it at nutrisense.io. And then you can follow us on Instagram at NutriSense.io. We're always posting, you know, research or things we're learning, things we're talking about. So pretty active there. And then, you know, me personally, you can follow me on Twitter is where I'm most active, Kara Collier One. So always talking about something that's happening in the world of glucose and metabolism.
So awesome. I love that. Well, I love what you guys are up to, what you're creating, and the difference you're making in the world as it relates to this all-pervasive issue, and certainly how this all impacts sleep. So I just really appreciate you coming on and sharing all of your amazing wisdom, particularly since, like you said, you're pretty much a subset of one, you know, of the mm-hmm. amount of people that actually have this sort of data on largely healthy or relatively healthy individuals. So this has really been a fascinating conversation.
Absolutely. It was super fun. Thanks, Molly.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Sleep is a Skill podcast, the number one podcast for people who want to take their sleep skills to the next level. Every Monday, I send out something that I call Molly's Monday Obsessions, containing everything that I'm obsessing over in the world of sleep. Head on over to sleepisaskill.com to sign up.